One of the things that really compels me is the problem of history, especially the history of Indigenous peoples. And then last, my own history. Where do I fit in as a Native woman? And how does my experience and the experience of a Native individual speak to the group as a whole? In my family, it was the women of my mother's side who were demonstrably Indian. But my grandmother and great-grandmother could not be bothered with explaining what it was to be Indian. They were too busy being Indian, or rather forgetting to be Indian. It was my mother, Sharon, who most clearly remembered for me how she was Cowlitz, but not through the tribal meetings or ceremony or even the white man's genealogies. Although I was raised by my great-grandmother and my mother to be proud of my native heritage, none of the traditions and life ways of my tribe were explained or contextualized for me. My mother had no language to describe our native life ways, and hence no direct way to describe our experience. And yet, and though I was raised with a quiet awareness of belonging, one I am still trying to understand. I grew up fishing, hunting berries, eating venison, digging clams, picking fern. These were merely the motions of my everyday life, caught and woven into memory. My mother never talked about these common acts as tribal, though I do believe that they were, and I do believe that they are. She taught me through the radio instead, through popular culture of the mid-70s, through resistance to Paul Harvey's conservative radio rants, through admiration of the Cherokee Armenian superstar Cher, but not her husband Sonny. As James Clifton has noted, the 70s brought a Native renaissance, and my mother seemed to respond to it. In 74, as we drove to North Dakota to visit my Norwegian stepfather's relatives, the memory of Dennis Banks, still fresh, brave, deep in Dakota, holding off the feds with a pitchfork, as Cherokee people blared on the radio, the long, straight stretches of an endless Montana seemed to hum, "Cherokee people will return." I was 9 or 10. I liked thinking I was an Indian who would return, but where? I was never sure. Thinking he was stealing her for the hatred that ran thick as blood in the Dakotas those days, red versus white, I remember my father saying to my mother flat out, "Don't tell them you're Indian." His remark was essentially heard as a challenge by my mom, who was paler than my grandmother and able to pass for white. Later in the trip, we visited my stepfather's best friend, a Sioux man living on government land he'd inherited. I played in a river near his property with his chubby blonde children, slapping the water with the back of my hand. It fractured, airborne, breaking in drops, reflecting the day, the blue-white sky and the red earth. My mother also taught me about being Indian through pithy aphorisms. She likes to think she's a squaw, still thinks the word squaw is okay, and she's famous for spouting essentializing indignities like, quote, "Those Cree Indians, they were mean as hell. That's why we're mean. We got this streak." Like so many Natives, we're a mix of Indian blood, and so we are also Cree, not just Cowlitz. Sometimes it was a quieter and perhaps more authentic knowing that my mother passed, as when she'd tell me about growing up in Washington, near to the land of her native kin, the land that we had been on for thousands of years in a place called Pigeon Springs. She'd share stories of Great Aunt Lucy out by the well, singing a song in the Salish language. It was pretty. It was haunting, my mom would recall, and I would embroider the memory, as it seems my place to do, imagining Lucy's lost song twining above the pine of Pigeon Springs, lilting, and eventually silent. In the silence, I began to listen and ask questions. I began to construct my identity as Indian. It was there, and like others of my age and generation in the Cowlitz tribe, I began to see through its seeming opacity. I began the process of learning what it was and what it might be